We're going to go to Belfast, and we're going to actually link up with a friend of ours, Quentin Oliver. Quentin has been, a contributor to our program for Friends We Can't Even. It's for well more than a decade anyway. And we got to know about you, Quentin, because of your company. And you are the founder, of again, Stratagem. And you might give us just a little flavor of, A, how you got into the business of conflict resolution in the first place.
Indeed. But firstly, let me wish you all a happy Mayo Day. I've been listening with interest to all the shenanigans and the good crack going on around that.
Quentin, many of us, and many of us being as parochial as we are, would imagine that or would be comfortable with, the thought that it was only Catholics in Northern Ireland, nationalists, who wanted the, Good Friday Agreement. But a little bit on your own background, you did not grow up in a nationalist Catholic area in Belfast. So tell us a bit about, the atmosphere when you were growing up and from your particular neck of the woods there.
Indeed. Well, I was brought up in East Belfast. And just by saying that geographical term, you will know that is a largely Protestant part of Belfast. I was told as I was growing up that my father had a Protestant job, whatever that was. We lived in a Protestant house, whatever that was. I went to a Protestant school, which I could just about understand. There were no Catholics there. And I never knowingly met a Catholic until my elder brother brought one home to consternation as his girlfriend. So that it explains some of the isolation that we all felt. But I understood that you couldn't continue that isolation, that wasn't going to help them and us, and it wasn't going to help if they beat us or we beat them. It had to have a win-win in it, because we're all the same. We've all got the same broad social aspirations for a better society, although we may have different political and constitutional aspirations. So that's why I was a firm backer of the Belfast Agreement, and you're right, nearly all nationalists supported it because it was progress for them from where they perceived themselves to be in a part of the UK that they didn't plead allegiance to. So the debate was within unionism. The Protestant unionists and the loyalists were debating, was this a step forward to underpinning their aspirations to stay in the UK, or was it a stepping stone to United Ireland? And that was the contest we had in the debate 25 years ago about whether to support the Good Friday Agreement or not in the referendum.
You were at the forefront, as a matter of fact, the leader of what became known as the yes vote. Well, of course, there were those who said no to the prospects of any agreement at that stage, particularly the Good Friday Agreement. But you designed the iconic, yes, no vote, leading up to the Good Friday Agreement. Was there, in hindsight, on your program to encourage people to vote? A lot of things happening, but was tell us about the breakdown. I'm playing devil's advocate here, which I'm supposed to be good at. In the Catholic areas, in the Protestant areas, in the nationalist areas, in the unionists, that division in the north, was there somewhat of a competition, as it were, to promote, you know, through your unique invention of this push to get the vote out? Was that something that, well, you could define along sectarian lines?
This was the first big policy issue that broke sectarian lines. And that's why we had a broad-based campaign that brought Catholics and Protestants and lots of others together, with a couple of Americans volunteering for our campaign, because it was a sign of progress for nationalists and for unionists, was our argument. Broadly in favour, because they felt that in Ireland, statelet, the Protestant Parliament for the Protestant people, the way the RUC was alleged to have behaved, they thought all of that was going to change, therefore that was good, therefore they were going to support this step forward. But unionism was deeply worried. They were concerned about sharing power with parties that would include Sinn Féin. They were scared about prisoner release, that IRA prisoners from the Maze would be released and might then run for office and might then become ministers in the government. They were concerned about the lack of definitive promises on decommissioning of weapons. So were they going to be sharing power? Were unionists going to be sharing power with nationalists and Republicans who still had a private army? They were worried about the future of the RUC, the police force that was 93% Protestant at the time. So they had genuine concerns. And our job was to soften those concerns, to persuade them that it was a step forward. And as Ken McGuinness, one of the unionist negotiators, now Lord McGuinness, said when he was making up his mind that Friday afternoon of Good Friday, he said, look, I've been through this for 30 years. The provost, the IRA, have tried to kill me 9 times. I shouldn't like this, but I have a duty to like this. I have a duty to make this work. I have a duty to stop the violence and stop people being killed. And that's what happened. And there are probably 1,500 people or more who might have been killed had we not had that agreement. So that's why we were very pleased that we got a majority of unionists to support it. A bare majority, it wasn't thumping. We reckon about 55%, just over half of unionists did support it. And that gave them mandate then for the power-sharing assembly at Stormont that has operated on and off for the last 25 years.
You know, if we go back over the decades on our side of the Atlantic here, particularly in the early days, there was very little coverage about conflict in Northern Ireland, other than, you know, the catchphrase was, you know, well, you know, the Protestants and the Catholics are in this religious affiliated state over there, and they're killing each other. That was kind of the image there, or the news as it was distributed. It was then difficult to say to people, this is not, it's got nothing to do with religion. It has to do, you know, with equal rights and, you know, civil rights, whatever. Was, going back to your own youth, was there a feeling, again, you were growing up in a Protestant area and representing that, was there a feeling, though, that there was, that Catholics, for instance, were, you know, one to be feared. There were those to be feared, and conversely, you know, was there that, you know, first of all, is it true that, you know, the religious definitions, that line absolutely was there. If you're Catholic, you're a nationalist. If you're not, you know, and obviously if you're Protestant, you're unionist. How was that interpreted for you on the ground there? And was that a different, was there a different approach in Ireland in terms of news in Northern Ireland?
There certainly was a very rigid division. As I said, I didn't meet Catholics when I was growing up, and there was a fear. I mean, my mum wouldn't let me out as a teenager, you know, after 7 o'clock at night, because it was perceived to be too dangerous if we went to the wrong area, if we fell in with the wrong people. And it was dangerous, and it was tense, and it was fearful. But I think you're right to say that the various parties, unionism and nationalism and republicanism, have grown up a lot over the last decades. Like, I can remember when I was in New York in 91 and in Boston, I can remember the very one-dimensional support for the IRA, the fundraising mm-hmm. for the IRA, and the lack of any sophisticated debate. And the good debates that were very small around kitchen tables. They weren't in public halls and on the streets. And I think that has shifted over 30 years. It's much more nuanced now. And there's a greater sophistication. However, that's not to say that we're reconciled. My kids went to integrated schools, so they know Catholics and Jews and Muslims and so on because of that, which is great. But only 7% of kids go to integrated schools, where they meet the other side and they meet diversity and other experiences. So it's not as if we're reconciled yet. And as you know, we still have a standoff over whether the DUP, the larger Unionist Protestants party, will take part in power sharing, because they have this objection about the Northern Ireland Protocol and the Windsor Framework and the attempts of the EU and the Irish government and the UK government to negotiate a deal on trading arrangements. So we're not there yet, and 25 years is a long time. And it's been grindingly slow for some of us during that 25 years. But it has held. As Bill Clinton said, it was an act of genius in terms of allowing people to be British and Irish, or both, to share power when they were willing, to govern their own affairs, and to argue for a united Ireland and a border poll on the one hand, if they did it peacefully and democratically, or to argue for the maintenance of the UK on the other hand. So it's a very solid peace agreement in that sense, and we shouldn't throw it away, but we need to make it work. We need to make it sing so that people can win the benefits from it.
What did the visit from President Joe Biden and the timing of his, you know, visit to Ireland, and obviously from north to throughout the south of Ireland, it wasn't a Cromwellian approach. It was the opposite. It was obviously designed to encourage, you know, the the reestablishment of you know, the ministry in Ireland that kind of fell apart and doesn't look like it's going to turn around anytime soon.
Indeed, the Biden visit was deeply divisive, I'm afraid, as so many things are here, and there were some unionists who were hostile and suggested that he was anti-British in public before he came, and that reflected their sensitivities and their concerns about the way he manifested his Irishness, which for many people was perfectly natural. You'll know this, Adrian, if you're an American with Irish roots, you cherish them, you may go on parades and manifest them, or you may toast St. Patrick, or you may enjoy a whiskey with an E now and again, and that's perfectly natural, and that flows through to political beliefs in a sense. Now, it's not as hard and fast as it was. You and I can remember what it was like in the Tammany Hall days and in terms of how votes were carved up and cast. So it's not as strictly linked as that. But there is an Irish vote. There is an Irish-linked president, even though he's also got British links, and that's perfectly logical. And he explained that in the Hall, in the sense he's a good Northern Ireland representative because he has Irish roots and he has English roots, and that's what a lot of us here feel. You know, we look in both directions. We can be Irish, we can be British, we can work north, south, east, west. So it was a triumph of a visit in the south. It was a triumph of a visit in the north for half the people, but I'm afraid there were some who thought that it was a diplomatic dance that wasn't worth it.
What about again on the heels of the Biden visit to have, you know, former President Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and of course Senator George Mitchell, who you know, was one of the not really one, I think deservedly he should take the credit for tipping that at the weird hour of the night over to acceptance of the Good Friday Agreement. Did it look like maybe there was a a gang up, and that might be interpreted as saying, you know, with Sunak and showing up there, followed by again the Clinton and those. Was there some kind of a feeling, did many suspect that this was a Sinn Féin, this was a nationalist boost? Not entirely,
because obviously some unionists objected because they still see the American establishment, especially personified by Irish Joe, Mayo Joe, at the moment, as potentially less friendly. So there is a bloc who saw scary factors in all of that. However, on the other hand, there was a huge bloc, and not just nationalists and Republicans, but also those in the middle, and we split about a third, now a third unionist, a third nationalist Republican, and a third who say, a plague in both your houses, we're not nationalists, we're not unionists, we're citizens, and we have a settlement that allows us to be Irish and British, that allows us trade into the EU and into the UK, and we're very happy with that. So that block of two-thirds was visibly moved and supportive of the incredible array at that conference, of the 25-year conference that was held in Belfast a week after President Biden came, because it had all those key players: George Mitchell, 89, leukemia treatment, and still he travelled with Hillary, his wife Hillary, and spoke movingly and effectively. Clinton, both Clintons, as you say, and lots of other players who'd made a key part, Tony Blair from the UK government, Bertie Ahern, and that's what we need again. Those two, Prime Minister and Taoiseach, working together for Ireland and the UK. So it was a remarkable review and reflection on what had been achieved, and a really positive agenda for the future. You know, people laying out what they had anticipated and what was now needed. And there was a helping hand to the DUP, who may have got into a bit of a corner with their Brexit position in 2016, and then their protocol opposition, and now their Windsor Framework opposition. So there were a few hands of friendship being thrown out there to find a way to allow them to get back into storm and to govern, because we're facing the cost of living crisis, energy bills, a dreadful budget because the UK government has not given us as much money as they could. It's what they call flat cash, the same money as last year, but with 10% inflation, that means it's 10% less. And in some areas, like health inflation is higher than 10%. So we have big social economic problems. We need our politicians to get round the table and solve them. And there was a huge boost to that by that gathering of such wise people. I mean, even at the Lyric Theatre, you'll have heard about the play, The Agreement, by Owen McCafferty. I mean, George Mitchell got a standing ovation when he popped in to see it, as did Hillary Clinton and others. So this affects the arts community, the culture community, the theatre community. There's people playing music, writing poetry. There's an upsurge in demand for freedom of expression and for a better politics to serve the people.
My guest friends, Quentin Oliver, conflict resolution specialist, and Beyond Ireland, again, as founder and chair of your sister company there, Stratagem, Stratagem International, providing backstop capacity, infrastructure, bringing experience and networks across Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, and Asia, and so forth. There, as you and as your clients, look at your company and reach out for you in particular, is some of that related to, do your clients, say, look at Northern Ireland, and would they presume that this is a success story?
They do. And while I'll admit that sometimes that's a bit embarrassing because it hasn't been a triumphant success, it has stopped us killing each other. It has reduced the violence. It has created institutions that can allow all parties to sit around the same tables. It has softened the edges of division. However, it's not a triumphant success. But what people recognize in other places is the foundation stones of that agreement, that you have significant minorities that deserve to be treated with respect, and their issues and grievances deserve to be managed and dealt with properly, and that it covers everything from human rights and equality to transportation to east-west relations, north-south, to community relations, to the role of women, to the role of integrated education. So it is a comprehensive agreement that covers a lot of ground. It was ahead of its time. It was an act of genius at the time. Now we need to make it work.
And there are those who are, I suppose we all are waiting with bated breath to find out, when that last little piece of the jigsaw puzzle will be in place. What is your own opinion of that? Will that come at all? Will that come, but it'll take time? The re-establishment, obviously, of the Assembly is what most people cannot understand, considering that, you know, for centuries what we wanted, you know, was as a country, you know, to have home rule, rule ourselves. We don't need any assistance from Mother England. What's your guess on this? Is it going to be a long time? Is it going to be something that, you know, that we should hold our breath for cooling our soup? What's your evaluation on that, Quentin Oliver?
Well, let me make a bold prediction, Adrian. I think that there will be a restored power-sharing assembly at Stormont. There will be an executive formed with Michelle O'Neill from Sinn Féin as First Minister and the DUP representative as Deputy First Minister. And that will happen this year. It's possible the earliest would be in June after the local government elections, which we're fighting at the moment. Or if not June, then later in the fall, in September or October. All the signs, and I've been watching this for 30 years and more, all the signs are that it's going in the right direction.